This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and fresh from a beachside brawl, local celebrity chef and culinary icon Tiffany Faison is here with us in Studio 2. Tiffany, welcome back.
Oh, it's so nice to be here, Tiziana. Thank you.
It's great to have you, and I actually meant it. You just finished your latest Food Network show, Beachside Brawl, and it's got this kind of East Coast, West Coast competition.
Yep.
To see who does boardwalk food, beachy food the best. Tell us about it.
Little breezy, little beefy. Yeah. So it's the East Coast versus the West Coast. Brooke Williamson was the captain and mentor for the West Coast. I was captain and mentor for the East Coast. We got to choose our teams. We each had four culinary competitor chefs that came on and represented each coast. Antonio LaFaso was the host and also judge. It was from Brian Landone and Guy Fieri, who have a production company. So much fun. We actually filmed it earlier in the spring, but we just finished airing it. Spoiler alert, the East Coast does not prevail this time, but...
Yes, and we will talk about that. But yeah. I want to start. So you picked your team.
I did.
I have a question because you have four people on the team. This is the East Coast team. We have one from Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
We have one from New Jersey. We have two from Florida. Mm-hmm. What exactly are we calling the East Coast here?
We are calling the entire Eastern Seaboard the East Coast. So we took a liberal scoop of the Eastern Seaboard for this. You know, it's interesting because I got to choose my team, but I also had to pick from people that reached out or the casting producers found. So
I did have
a pool of people. Exactly. So I started with probably about 20 people. And there were not a lot of people from like our area, from Boston and Cape Cod. I certainly would have maybe tried to have a more robust representation. But we had a few people. I had Chef Ben, who was great, and he's from Harwich, has a restaurant in Harwich, and he did really well. All-star guy, just really sweet human being, really good cook. So I was happy to have him on my team. But I had him, Jared Brown from New Jersey. I had Jada Vidal from Florida, and then also Chef Edward Lorman from, like, he's kind of Florida, Alabama, like Pensacola area. So.
And he was the one that made it furthest.
He did. He made it the furthest. He and Jada. Jada was, like, next to last, and then Ed made it to the final with me.
Because it was a competition.
It was.
Somebody wins. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Brooke Williamson, who I know is a friend of yours.
Yes.
And I was so curious to see this because I got to go back a little bit. All right. So you bested her in the third Tournament of Champions.
Correct.
And my favorite moment still from that is when the two of you meet outside your trailer the morning of the finale. Here it is.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Ready to go down?
Ready to go. Good luck to you.
Down. I said go down.
No.
So I have to admit, I could not throw down with somebody like that face to face, but you did. So did this have that same competitive vibe? Because this time around, Brooke comes out on top. Last time, you clearly did.
Yeah. So it's it does have a competitive vibe. We're all such competitors. It doesn't matter what you put us in. If you told us all hold hands and save the world, we'd be like, which one does it first? Like, as much as we do enjoy each other and respect each other as cooks and as people, we're so competitive. So yes, I took Brooke down in season 3 of Tournament of Champions. She came back and took my East Coast team down. Let's split hairs. I'll take the L, but, there's agreeing with it and not agreeing. I'm not contesting it, but I really am so proud of my East Coast chefs, and I think that they just did such an incredible job. We had such a really incredible team, like the camaraderie and the sense of family and helping each other and what we learned together as the East Coast team was just, it was so much fun and extraordinary and really special. Really special.
So let's talk about the food a little bit, and it may be because it's 11 a.m. and I'm hungry. But some of these recipes they had, you know, we're talking, you know, things like scallops and coconut and pineapple and shrimp and then lemongrass and
sure.
What was one of your? What's like one dish that you're still fantasizing about? Like I want to eat that again.
That someone made or that I made?
That someone made.
I think about Jada's fish and chips that she made right out of the gate, and it was we all had to make like boardwalk specialties, and she did this really beautiful fish and chips with like a turmeric kind of curry battered on her fish, and then her chips were plantains with a chimichurri on top of it. And I never really thought about doing plantains as the chip. It was so lovely, and just the fish came through, the plantains were great, curry was really lovely, and then the chimichurri that she made, super bright, herbaceous, acidic. It was just really beautiful.
And I kind of can't imagine that there's any ingredient that you have never included with some other any ingredient, but did you discover from any of the chefs in this something new? I mean, like plantain chips, but where you're doing something different in your own cooking now as a result?
I learn from them all the time. And this is, I think, one of the things that such a gift about having new people that come into the kitchens, whether it's on a competition, whether it's in the restaurants. And it's one thing I really say to new cooks that come in. So I sometimes feel, and I remember being 100,000 years ago when I was a new cook, I remember being so intimidated by being in a kitchen and the process and thinking that you couldn't contribute, thinking that you really had to keep your head down and sort of go through all of the lessons and the ropes and never open your mouth. And that was really, you know, the culture of kitchens. But I say it all the time to new cooks that come to the kitchen that there are things that will be obvious to you that might be easier or better or combinations of flavors that we should try that you don't think that you assume that we already know. And we don't, because sometimes we're just stuck in the fallacy of tradition or we don't see the thing that's right in front of us that'll make our lives easier or whatever. So we talk about mentioning that and not being afraid to say that. Conversely, we don't make fun of or put people down for saying things that might seem a little bit obvious if we have thought of it. If we haven't, it's not like, oh, we just don't do that. We think through it, think past the answer. Does it make sense?
And do you find that that's still the culture in Boston kitchens now, the keep your head down, don't speak up, do your job, learn the ropes? Or culturally, have our kitchens started to change?
I think it's not just speaking for Boston. It's speaking for all kitchens. I think there's a mix of both. There are kitchens that have changed culturally and welcome more collaborative environments in them. And then there are some that are just keep it down, don't talk, don't, you know. And if I'm being entirely honest, there are times when I'll have younger cooks that come in, and it's about knowing when to speak up and knowing, or, you know, finding a time to say something. Like having a brand new chatty Cathy that wants to tell you how to do your job all the time when they just started cooking 5 minutes ago is not my favorite environment in a kitchen.
How do you give that feedback?
We have a little conversation that's away from like the rest of the cooks about focus and making sure that I think the best contributors are always the best listeners.
Yeah.
And then when you have something that's really burning a hole that you need to say, let's say that.
So, you know, in the arc of this conversation just now, we went from TV to cooking to being a chef. And I actually want to sort of meta talk about that arc a little bit. I've been thinking, as I've gotten to know you better, I've wondered how you balance your life as a chef and a business leader and a mentor, which you talk about a lot with your own restaurants, with your growing profile as a television personality and really a TV star. Are you finding that's an easy balance to keep? Is that tough?
No, it's totally tough. I don't think any balance is easy. When people talk about balance and what that means, I think it's not specific to my profession or having multiple different hats that you wear. I think what I've found is the idea of having it all, I think, is really a myth anyway. What is your all? What matters to you? Like, those are, I don't have children. I don't have, you know, I don't have that weight of my life to manage and hold. So in some ways, I don't have the commitment at home that a lot of women have. So I can kind of, you know, if I get home at 11 o'clock, midnight, 2, it doesn't matter. There's no one that's hungry that needs to be fed. And I don't have to deal with that side of my life. So that's been out of design and circumstance. But the other parts of it, putting on different hats, I think you can have parts of it at different times. I don't think you can have all of it all of the time. So it's about, for me, communicating what's happening in my life and what the priorities are at any given time. If I'm traveling and shooting a lot, then I have to communicate that to my teams, and they need to know that. And the people that support me in the business are aware of that. And then if there are times that I'm really, like, very focused on the restaurants and what we're doing and spending more time in the restaurants, then the other side of my life needs to know about that, too. I can't leave for 2 days and bounce out and shoot something that doesn't matter. And not that things don't matter, but I'm not going to go do something that's like a one-off that isn't a part of something I'm already committing to.
And is that kind of the permanent future for you, that the finding the yin and yang here? I guess what I'm asking
you just asked me about permanent future, which is a non sequitur.
I'm sorry, what?
There's no permanent future anywhere.
So, but I guess what I am asking is, which one are you, first and foremost? What's your calling?
I'm a chef. Yeah, I'm a chef first. And I think that will always remain. But your life changes, right? And it arcs and it moves in different directions. And I think sometimes, especially with chefs, there's this idea that if I'm not in my kitchens every second of the day, all the time, what is she doing? And I grew up with that, and I still hear it, not just myself, but other people were like, oh, she's not in her kitchen anymore. That chef's not in his kitchen. And there are times I'm like, guys, they've been cooking for 25 years. They don't have to be in their kitchens every second of every day. And if they are, maybe you should give more autonomy and teach better and give more to the people that work with you. So nothing is one thing forever. I am and will always be a chef. I do really enjoy this other side of my life, and it's a lot of fun. And it's not being a chef. It's just being a chef in a different way.
We're talking with local celebrity chef Tiffany Faison here in Studio 2 today. I understand, so we've been talking about this television and chef. Mm-hmm. I understand that there is a television chef, fictional, who is intriguing you right now.
Intriguing everyone.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah,
so this is
this
Hulu series, The Bear.
Yeah.
And it's starring, I got to look his name up, Jeremy Allen White of mm-hmm. Shameless fame. He was amazing in Shameless.
Incredible in Shameless and also incredible in this.
So why do you find, why is everybody finding it so intriguing?
Well, I think different people and outlets for different reasons. And it's been very interesting to see how the world has kind of responded to this. The chef world, and I'm not going to speak for all of us, but I'll kind of speak, I will generalize because I feel like the sentiment is pretty consistent. The show got it right in a way that we haven't seen that happen yet.
Got what right?
Almost everything. The details of the kitchen, nuance of difficult leadership, a young chef that's hungry, that's in circumstances that are trying and difficult and trying to lead a team in very almost impossible circumstances, trying to be true to themselves and also do what's right sort of for the restaurant, trying to be a leader to other cooks in the kitchen. I mean, so they got that right. They got the camaraderie in the kitchen right. They got, you watch the pastry chef in The Bear, who I think was so extraordinary. I forget what the actor's name was.
And he's a local actor, I believe.
He is. Yeah, he's incredible. Lionel Boyce stole the role as the pastry chef. And what you see in that, that I think chefs really recognize, is someone who goes from just like doing a thing to understanding that the thing can be done better and that there's a community of people out there that are doing it at a very high level, and that infects this pastry chef. And you start to see him, like, the eyes widen, and he becomes really obsessed with what he's doing. And then you see the dynamics, like, you know, he starts to want to make donuts, and he's talking to this young sous chef that's kind of having a similar experience about leadership and what that means for her. And you see him talk to her about, you know, can I make donuts? She knows that it's impossible. We don't have the equipment. We don't have the time. We don't really have the resources. But you don't want to kill the fire. And you just go, okay, so yes, let's give it a shot. Let's see how it goes. And then the donuts take over the kitchen. And then his normal stuff isn't getting done. Like, I've seen that happen.
You've seen this play.
I've done it. When the fire just catches hold. I loved that they did not make Carmi, who is the protagonist, the chef, an addict. I mean, he's dealing with some codependency issues, which I think is so interesting to talk about.
And by the way, just for listeners, he's a young guy who's taken over his brother's kitchen in a restaurant.
He comes back to Chicago after being at a kitchen that is so clearly made into being 11 Madison Park in New York City. And he's simultaneously trying to hold up the family business, prove himself, find a path forward, deal with incredible amounts of grief. And he does it in a way that is so not obvious, right? Like, there's no blatant sexual harassment. He has a sous chef that is played by Ayo, what's her last name? Edibiri, I think.
Who is a local actor.
Unbelievable. She's unreal. And they give her own personality, her own storyline, her own life. She's not just there to be hit. She's never hit on. They don't have any sort of sexual relationship. So refreshing. Because you always see that's just like, it's a crutch that it goes to, you know, that they don't do it, which is great. There's definitely abuse, and there's, you know, trying to handle the pressure of the kitchen that you see through Jeremy's character. But, you see all of these things kind of come together in a way that doesn't – he's not an alcoholic, and he's not, you know, hitting on someone, and he's dealing with the pressure in a different way. Does it come out well? No. Is he handling it well? No. But they didn't take shortcuts, and they didn't take cheap shots.
So we were just talking about the Hulu series, The Bear, there with Tiffany Faison, who's here in Studio 2. I'm going to go back in time a little bit now, because the last time you were here, you were getting ready to throw out the first pitch at Fenway Park on Pride Night.
Got it across the plate.
You did. You were getting ready. So I want you to bear with me, because I want listeners to come back to that day and understand the journey. So here's what you told us that day about how you were feeling about it.
I can't even process what tonight is and what, like, I've been letting it kind of come in waves, or else I think it's just going to overwhelm me to the point of either not being able to function or crying or something. You know, I'm just trying to let it in little pieces, little bites at a time. And it's every time I let myself think about it, I just think,
I can't believe this is my life.
So then you throw out the first pitch that night, accompanied by drag queens Sassination, Coleslaw, and Pamela Manderson.
Here to throw out a ceremonial first pitch, please welcome Tiffany Faison.
Crazy.
All right, Tiffany, how about a pitch?
So crazy.
Okay, but then the next morning, yeah, your Twitter feed, yep, says, last night I had one of my favorite life moments surrounded by the love and support of my sweet friends. This morning, I woke up to a bunch of hateful BS comments. Mm-hmm. So, and I want to note for listeners that you weren't frowning until I got to that line. You were beaming until I got to that line, which tells me that those hateful comments couldn't take away from you.
No. I mean, they exist in two separate boxes for me. This moment that will never, ever be diminished or dimmed was such an extraordinary moment of my life. People don't get that. I still can't, but like, you played the audio and I just can't, I still can't believe it. It was just unbelievable. And there wasn't any second in that experience that I didn't understand exactly where I was and what was happening and what we were doing. And the privilege and the honor that I felt to be there was just next level. I live in a admittedly self-created bubble. I know that there's homophobia out there. I know that it's in the world. I live in Boston. I travel to New York and LA and, you know, usually larger cities, and I don't feel it that much. And so I don't really have people come for me and call me, you know, a dyke or say that I'm a groomer or my friends are groomers, or I don't experience that from day to day. I don't think it's a positive thing to experience, but it was a little bit of a wake-up call to kind of pop the bubble and understand that even in the region and the area and the country that we live in that feels pretty protected, there's still stuff.
Well, yeah, and the reason I really wanted to bring it up, and I appreciate you letting me, is because, I mean, just last week we had drag performer Patty Bure here, yep, on the show after performing Drag Queen Story Hour in JP and being protested by neo-Nazis.
What is happening? What is happening? This door that has been opened that has, and let's not pretend that people weren't there, right? There have always been neo-Nazis. There have been white supremacists. And by that, I mean disgusting racists. It's always been there. There's been homophobes. There's just, you know, I think 5 or so years ago, we had a door open and it permitted people to come out and to express that in a way that is less shameful than it used to be. I don't understand it. I never will. I'm going to continue to fight against it at every turn. I think for me, you know, and I so appreciate the Red Sox and the support of them and Nesson. For me, the difficulty, aside from the obvious conversation that was happening online and the abuse, was, you know, it's and the gay community talks about this, the queer community talks about this a lot, that in June, like, everyone's, you know, logo gets turned into a pride flag, and then, you know, July 1st is like, who, you know, like, we barely knew you. And I think, you know, I'm in conversation with the Red Sox and with Nesson and want to continue to talk to them about this, but I don't think you just get to a wash your logo in rainbows and then not deal with the fallout of it. And so I think it's important to have the conversation of, okay, it happened, but what's next? Because for me, when I was young, I think when you're in any way experiencing something that is not the mainstream in your life, and I'll speak for queer people, even before I could put a name to it, I knew I was different in a way that things that were talked about around the gay community, around lesbians, around queer people, I had an antenna up for that I didn't even understand why at the time. And so what scares me, or I think sticks with me the most and bothers me, is that I know that there's, you know, a young queer kid somewhere that is following the Red Sox, is playing softball or baseball or whatever it is, and had a moment or was there and said, this is freedom and this feels good and this is possible and I can, you know, unclench my jaw and let my shoulders down a little bit, and then saw that the next morning. And all of that conversation that was allowed on, you know, Nesson and Red Sox social media, it says to that kid, it's not safe and it's not okay and you're not okay. And none of that is true. There are no out MLB players, right? So until that is not the case, I think it is really important that we protect those spaces and make sure that the hateful speech is not part of mainstream communication for, you know, whether it's NFL, MLB, NBA, whatever it is, that we allow kids to grow up in and know that they can come out and play professional sports and be in any environment and be safe.
All right. There will be so much more for us to talk about, yeah. but we get to do this again.
Yes.
So for now, Boston restaurateur, culinary star Tiffany Faison, great to have you.
So thanks. Nice to be here, Tiziana. Thank you.